back in order for this afternoon's business. For those of you just joining us, we took care of one of the afternoon's business items, rulemaking on adaptive management program reform, which takes care of before lunch, just to be a little bit ahead of schedule. We have two public comment periods to begin the afternoon session. One is a general public comment period. Tricia, do you have a sign up for general public comments? We have two, first of which is Chris Mendoza. Would you come join us, please?
Good afternoon, Chair and Board. I want to thank you first again for entertaining my yield this morning. And I'll only be a couple minutes, but I wanted to just respond briefly to some of the adaptive management concerns that were raised this morning. And I wanted to give them from the perspective of the CMER co-chair position as having been to CMER meetings. While I respect and understand some of the concerns that policy members have, we rarely see policy members at CMER meetings, if ever, with the exception of possibly Pete Ivey before he decided to move on. So, and I'll be brief, as I said. I think that some of the concerns outlined with resource, human resources, and concerning the flow of research and monitor information to policy, as you heard, there's a lot on your plate that comes from CMER to policy and then eventually to the board. And so I think more than anything, what that a reflection of is that CMER does get things done. Once we get our hands around a project, it doesn't take much to get it moving. I mean, it may take some to get it moving, but once it's moving, it moves pretty quickly. And because our focus is on research and monitoring results that respond directly to the HCP. In other words, for those of you that have looked at the HCP, may realize that there's specific critical questions surrounding resources and the potential effects of the prescriptions on those resources, aquatic resources, that really keep CMER's focus fairly narrow regarding those. However, the bigger issue I think that was failed to be raised earlier is that policy has a much broader agenda in a lot of ways than what CMER's tasks are. In other words, once they get information from CMER, then it's obvious, but it's worth repeating, then there may be policy implications for that information. And that's where things really get hung up. And so I think the chair's comments were right on point, having been to most policy meetings over the last 5 years, that they don't have as narrow of a focus. And that's not a judgment thing, or it's a judgment in any way, shape, or form. It's just that I think in efforts to reach consensus, they have a lot more side alleys to go down, if you will, than CMER per se. So in closing, I wanted to, first of all, thank the chair for committing the resources to an additional CMER staff member. I think that that in itself will hopefully and fill that gap, and because when it comes to scoping a study design, it really doesn't take much time. And my opinion is that we have enough CMER members that can scope a study design, having scoped several myself and having others scope study designs. That doesn't take time. It's the actual PI, the principal investigator, that dedicates half their time to following through on the study. That is a commitment, and I think that's why there have been a limited number of CMER members to step into the PI role. And then lastly, I wanted to just give my own personal update on a couple of things that hang up that are also limitations on CMER members that are indirect responses to more or less not the research, but to policy's lack of responses to work. And I think that you'll find that a lot of policy decisions get pushed onto technical groups that aren't CMER per se, but it turns out that most of the folks that serve on those technical groups are CMER members representing those stakeholders. So their workload can quickly double, and as a evidence of that is type F, type N. Anytime there's an issue that is not resolved at the policy level, often technical folks get brought into that realm. And that also takes more resources. And then lastly is the lean process. If you recall, you approved three pilots to to go to CMER to go through the lien process. And at present, that's having limited success in some areas more so than others. And I think it's because of the limitations on full stakeholder involvement at the initiation of some of these projects. But I'm hopeful that we can work some of those bugs out.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you for your time.
The next general public commenter is Rob Cavanaugh.
Hello, board members, chair. My name is Rob Cavanaugh, and I wanted to talk with you about the procedures and processes that are used in the petitioning or rulemaking process within the Forest Practices Board. I think there's a lot of need for change there. Now, I have this excellent handbook, and I hope that many of you have seen it. It's the Forest Practices Illustrated Guide. It's really well written. And I got it from a DNR staff. And I'd like to also thank the staff for helping me understand the rulemaking process and the various laws. Without their help, Mrs. Payne was one of them, and without Joe Glazik and your public records staff, I could not function. And yet, Mr. Goldmark has issued a letter out that I may not talk to them. And I think that is a big mistake. So that is one of my concerns. I suggest the following reforms and procedures be adopted by the Forest Practices Board. First of all, follow similar procedures that we use in legislative bill drafting. I draft bills, I've drafted dozens and dozens of them. And we usually work with an interdisciplinary committee. And the committee for the representative that's involved in these bills, so that we get stakeholder input, we understand the dynamics of what laws we're making, and we understand, very importantly, what the economic situation will be if this bill passes, because these things have tremendous costs in people and time and resources. I suggest you assign a staff to draft the proposed petition, working with the public stakeholders and the proponent, using an interdisciplinary team of experts in analysis in law, science, and economics, especially in doing fiscal notes. This is critical. The next one is draft proposed rules and give adequate time for the proponent to thoroughly discuss the issue with the board before the board is asked to vote. You cannot vote on a petition that I give you in 2 minutes. I couldn't even describe it to you properly in 2 minutes, so we need more time than that. Ensure access for the proponent to knowledgeable staff. Well, when Goldmark tells me I can't talk to the staff, that's not productive. That's wrong. I have to have access to the staff because they have the expertise. They are the scientists. If you look at how these timber sales are run, that's a prime example of how we should do business. They're thoroughly analyzed. Well done. So another point that I would like you to consider is that you must ensure truthfulness, honesty, and fairness. And when board members conspire the day before I make my petition to deny my petition, that's not being honest with the board. They never disclosed to you what they did. Yet we have the emails from them that show that's exactly what they did. So I was sitting here thinking I had a legitimate shot at making this rule, and I never did. They had already disapproved it, and I have the record that shows that. Require that the minutes of the Forest Practices Board meeting be accurate and complete. When I got the minutes, the written minutes, they missed half of what I said and half of the questions that you asked. That's not right, and I'm getting a transcript of that. And these minutes are vital because that's what you go forward with. Now, they're saying that there's an agreement between Department of Fish and Wildlife and DNR to do certain things to protect western gray squirrels. Yet when we checked with the director's office, there is no agreement, period. And yet somebody from this agency sent that to the governor. And the governor sent back to me, well, there's an agreement, don't worry. Well, there isn't an agreement. The chair violates this by putting out incomplete and unfactual minutes of the board meeting and without providing a true transcript of the proceedings. Lastly, do not assume that the Forest Practices Board is going to be sued until I notify you I'm going to sue you. I have not done that. I have not alluded to that. I've talked with your attorney. She knows I'm not going to do it. So using that as a pretext for cutting off information to me is dead wrong, and it's got to be corrected. So that's my testimony today. And did they get a copy of this? Okay, thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
With that, we need to move on to the second public comment period of the afternoon regarding the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team's recommendations. Okay. So first we have we have 10 minutes reserved for public comment on Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team recommendations, and we have let's see, 8 folks wishing to comment, and so that doesn't leave you individually a great deal of time. I'm happy to, since we saved a little bit of time in the initial public comment period, we can add 5 or 10 minutes onto this one. I'll give you 3 minutes apiece. So Cindy Mitchell with WFPA, that's first person signed up to testify.
Good afternoon, Chairman and Board members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak about the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team recommendation. The Northern Spotted Owl is an issue with decades-old roots, and today I'm going to concentrate on the transformational vision that was given to that team by this board to change the current dynamic of fear and resistance to one of partnership and participation by focusing on voluntary incentive-based measures. The roots of the Spotted Owl issue stem back to the 60s, when Jimmy Carter encouraged accelerating harvesting on our federal forests to combat double-digit inflation at 13.5% by the early 80s. There was no doubt that that was an unsustainable level of harvest at 3% per year, and the environmental movement did us a great favor of helping to halt that pace of unsustainable harvest. 15 years later, it took another presidential solution to get us out of that situation with President Clinton and the Northwest Forest Plan and 24.5 million acres of federal forest. In Washington alone, 93% of the timber harvest was halted on federal forest. And then this board spent 4 years adopting a 500-acre emergency rule between 92 and 96. Individuals, companies, and the state also signed up for federal habitat conservation plans, adding another 2 million acres to owl conservation. Finally, the state's consensus rule went into effect, a TFW rule in 1996, which added 2.1 million acres in 10 spotted owl emphasis areas, complementing federal recovery. And that requires 5,900 acres on the west of I-5 and 2,600 acres of private land being set aside for owls. The federal assurances that were anticipated were never gotten because at the time, the outside of the SOCES, 51,000 acres was going to be released, and it was viewed as being harmful to fish. So this state, again, with private landowners, went into work, and they adopted the Forest to Fish Law, another 2 million acres, 60,000 miles of stream, affecting 9.3 million acres of forest. Those were the eras of the big problems solving big solutions. And this regulatory approach has added up to about 14 million acres in Washington state dealing with older forest, repairing buffers, and spotted owl. And then something transformational happened at this board. In 08, it put forth a vision, changing its focus from regulatory solutions to voluntary, incentive-based solutions that are economically sustainable. And the NSOIT was formed. In 2011, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Recovery Plan endorsed this NSOIT approach. 2012, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, with its critical habitat designation, excluded private lands from federal critical habitat and encouraged us to continue in this approach. And of course, the new challenge with the barred owl, which is the greatest competitor to the spotted owl. And as you know, the federal government is undertaking a $3 million unprecedented program to remove 3,600 barred owls to see if it will help the spotted owl survive.
We're running out of time, Cindy.
Today we've accomplished much with more than 20% of non-federal land and 90% of all federal forests off limits. In some cases, regulations have gone too far, but the board's new paradigm of cooperation and incentivizing landowners is providing real hope and a positive pathway forward, ending the era of owl wars. Thank you for that vision.
Next, we have Graham Taylor. Please join us. I think that's what that says.
That's what it says.
Thank you, Chair and Board. Good afternoon. My name is Graham Taylor. I'm a staff member with the Sierra Club. We're a conservation and recreation organization that represents a little over 30,000 activists and members across Washington State. We appreciate your interest in this issue, and we are dedicated to protection of spotted owls and hopeful for recovery of spotted owls. The Sierra Club has a long history engaging up with the northern spotted owl in an effort to conserve the species, and we're concerned about efforts on private and state land currently to really make up the difference in protecting owls over time. We've seen a decline of the spotted owl at a rate of something like 2.9% declining every year, roughly 40% decline in the last 25 years. This demonstrates that the practices and the policies that we're creating are not really contributing to a difference on the ground. And so the Sierra Club really would encourage the board to use its full authority to create the conditions on the ground that can work towards change and recovery of spotted owls. One issue and area of interest for the Sierra Club has been climate change recently. We met a couple years ago, and our members and activists identified climate as one of the biggest concerns that we have. And you know, when you think about climate change, you have to consider the adaptation side and the mitigation side, or how are we as a species and other wildlife going to adapt to changes that are already happening in their environment, and how can we mitigate climate change in the future so that we can stave off some of the worst impacts of climate disruption. And we think that private and state lands can play a role in both the mitigation and adaptation for climate change. Currently, we've seen federal lands try to take most of the burden for conservation, and that hasn't worked. And so it's really up to you guys to create those conditions for adaptation and mitigation. I know the implementation team has been going through some modeling processes to kind of identify what opportunities exist for habitat connectivity. Habitat connectivity is one key piece of the puzzle that I think that you guys can facilitate when you're trying to identify the stepping stones for how species of owls and other wildlife can migrate and adapt to changes in their environment, moving from the Olympics across private and state lands to the Cascades. If you look at a map, you'll see that the federal lands are really bulkily much in central Washington and on the Olympic Peninsula, and that there's a large gap in between, and that wildlife connectivity is going to require some kind of action, potentially more action than just action. It might require you guys to use some of your regulatory authority and go beyond some of the scope that you've seen since 2008 to achieve some of these goals on the ground. So
we're out of time here.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Appreciate it.
Sorry for the short time frames, folks. We just don't have that much time allocated to this. Next, we have Don Holubisky. I'm sure I butchered that. I apologize.
No, you got it right.
Good afternoon. My name is Don Holubisky, and I'm a volunteer with the Sierra Club. And a few years ago, I was probably the only unpaid volunteer on the Spotted Owl Working Policy Group that met monthly to try and help the spotted owl survive in Washington State. And it was a very painful experience for me because, not being familiar with policy, it seemed like I dropped in on a conversation that started 10 or 20 years ago and tried to catch up. But anyways, at the end of that year, we came up with recommendations to try and save the spotted owl. We patted each other on the back and had our picture taken with the governor and went our different ways. But in reflection, and from what I hear, and I'm just a volunteer, is that either we haven't carried out those recommendations or they weren't strong enough, but the spotted owl continues to decline. And so that's my concern is, did we do the right thing with that group, or do we have to do something that's stronger and go back and re-examine what we recommended and see where how on track we are. And, it seems like we haven't done enough. Thank you.
Thank you. I have Mark Johnston next.
Well, hello.
Mr. Chair and the board. My name is Mark Johnston. I'm testifying on behalf of myself. I am a long-term, a long-time member of the Sierra Club and also Seattle Audubon. I've been active with both, but I'm not testifying for either. I'm testifying as an interested person. For Seattle Audubon, I, for 5 years, have chaired their field trips committee. I now am the vice chair. I lead field trips, have done this for years and years and years. And so I come to this process as somebody who is an environmentalist, who appreciates nature. I lead field trips, I'm a birder, and I'm very aware that the spotted owl continues to decline, irregardless of the work that you've all done. I think this board certainly was an excellent idea when it was created. I understand it was established in 74, I think it is, and I think it's a great venue for sharing ideas, for everybody, you know, having research done, bring it back, share it, and so I think it's been good for that. But I share the concerns mentioned by Graham and the Sierra Club, and I don't see that it has improved the condition on the ground, the spotted owl. I think it's time, if this board is to actually accomplish as regards the spotted owl what it was set up to do, it's going to have to get a little tougher. And by that I mean, as Graham indicated, use some of your authority and address what we actually have to address on public land, private lands. I think it's much better on federal, but I want to see this board take more aggressive action. And if we're going to succeed, what has been done has not worked. I don't think it's been a good. The thought, but nobody seems to want to go where you have to go, which is to some of the private business interests, and it seems that we have to do that if we're going to actually see the situation start to turn for the better, so that birders and others will have this this bird as a resident for years to come in our state. And I know I'm very short on time. Regarding connectivity, there's a large population, I think you know, on the Olympic Peninsula and then in the Cascades, but the area between has been hammered, basically. There's just not habitat there. And I guess I would suggest, I don't think that that connection will be made unless the board maybe appoints a populations connection working group, something specifically to look at how are we going to connect these two separate populations, and designate that group to actually come up with a plan over a short time, and then do what is actually needed to be done if it's going to work. My point being, actually come up with a workable plan that will actually work on the ground, and then take some of the actions that I think nobody seems to want to take regarding private lands, but I think it's where you got to go if you're going to solve this. And that's what I have. Thank you. Thank you.
Next we have Sean Cantrell.
Good afternoon. I'm Sean Cantrell. I'm currently the Senior Policy Consultant with Seattle Audubon. As a reminder, for those of you who have been around or for news that are newer here, I was a member of the Northern Spotted Owl Policy Working Group back in 2009. I was actually the co-chair along with Mark Domit. And since 2010, I've been a member of the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team. What I want to say today, I'll try to be very, very short, is to say that you as a board need to get actively engaged in the spotted owl issues. You're under a statutory obligation, as well as there's the federal ESA and recovery plan issues that impact spotted owl and how you oversee the private lands in this state. And this board did task the implementation team to develop recommendations, and I hope and expect that we will have those for you in final form by November. But you all will need to be the decision makers. You know, the IT is only make recommendations. You're the ones that can make decisions within your realm and your statutory limitations. So between now and November, I would just urge you to take some time. Again, you guys have full-time jobs outside of this board, but take the time to read the materials that the Spotted Owl implementation team and the DNR staff will send you and provide you, so that when it gets to November and it's time to make decisions, that you'll have read that, you'll understood it, you'll have a chance to ask questions either at that meeting or in advance, so that you can in fact take action. I've been doing this for 6 or 7 years, and I look around and there's people who have been doing it a whole lot longer than that, and I'm frustrated that the pace has not been as quick as we could have and the OWL actually needs. So I would encourage you all to be ready at your November meeting, ask questions of staff today, read the materials between now and the next meeting, and be ready for action at the November meeting. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, Whitaker.
Good afternoon, board members, chair. I'm Kara Whitaker. I'm the staff scientist and policy analyst at the Washington Forest Law Center. And I wanted to convey to you the biological urgency under which stronger conservation measures are needed for the spotted owl. Washington's spotted owl populations have declined by roughly half during the last 15 or more years. And the steep decline should be cause for concern for the long-term sustainability of spotted owl populations throughout the entire range of the subspecies. Despite being listed for nearly two decades, the two biggest threats to spotted owl persistence continue to grow year after year. First, habitat continues to be lost faster than it's being restored, especially on non-federal lands. In the first decade of the implementation of the Forest Practices Rules for Owls, approximately 234,000 acres of nesting and roosting habitat was harvested on non-federal lands in our state alone. When disturbances in federal harvest are also taken into account, a total of 246,000 acres of nesting and roosting habitat were lost during this single decade. Second, barred owl populations continue to grow across the range of the spotted owl, and spotted owl territories are occupied less frequently when larger, more aggressive barred owls are present. The combined effects of habitat loss and fragmentation and intense barred owl competition increase the importance of conserving large amounts of contiguous old forest habitat to maintain northern spotted owls in the landscape. Barred owl management will likely also become a key element for successful spotted owl recovery. Because most federal lands are already on a trajectory to restore spotted owl habitat under the Northwest Forest Plan, non-federal lands now play a more critical role and providing the additional habitat spotted owls need in light of barred owl impacts. Accordingly, successful owl recovery will depend on full integration of the Forest Practices Rules and the Endangered Species Act. Time is of the essence for this board to act before it is too late to prevent the extirpation of spotted owls from our state. Thank you.
Thanks. Next we have Dave Wertz.
Mr. Chair and board members, my name is Dave Wertz. I serve as the Science and Conservation Director at Conservation Northwest. I'm here today to provide comment on the Spotted Owl Implementation Team and the board's upcoming decision on spotted owl conservation and recovery. First, I'd like to point out the obvious, which is what we're currently doing is not working. The spotted owl was listed as an endangered species in Washington State in 1988, almost 25 years ago, and yet the population continues a prolonged and accelerating decline. We're not meeting our obligations or to the people of Washington State to protect the public resources, including wildlife such as the spotted owl. Secondly, and also hopefully obvious, there is a scientific consensus that owls need habitat to survive and to recover. And habitat in large blocks that are well connected across the landscape are essential, particularly through Southwest Washington, between the Cascades and the Olympics, and between the Olympics and the Oregon Coast Range, but also along the North Cascades. And now owls need increased amounts of habitat because of barred owls that displace spotted owls and because of the anticipated effects of climate change. But we're losing habitat at an alarming rate, and it's not just in quantity, but it's in quality as well. There was a study in 2005 by the WDFW that determined that about 73,000 acres of important habitat was lost to logging between 1996 and 2004. And it was targeting areas that scientists identify as essential for conservation. About more than half of that logging of owl habitat occurred within board-established special emphasis areas for the spotted owl. And about half of that occurred right around nest sites. About 33,000 acres, almost the other half, occurred around nest sites outside of those special emphasis areas. And the highest proportion of loss of habitat occurred in Southwest Washington, where about half of the habitat present in 1996 was lost. Lastly, I'd like to say that board leadership is very important on this issue. It's very much needed. Over the last 20 years, the board has relied on stakeholder processes to establish policy. And in this case, the stakeholder processes work better for the political systems than they do for the biological systems. And I don't need to remind you that as a board, you have responsibility to both. So as this decision approaches about what incentives and rules will be needed to protect and restore older forest habitat for owls, I ask that you listen carefully to your science team and craft a policy that meets both your social and biological responsibilities. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Next we have Becky Kelly.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. My name is Becky Kelly, and I'm Deputy Director of the Washington Environmental Council. I want to speak out of turn very briefly, but so thank you, so hopefully I'll get away with it, which is to say thank you for the adoption of the Forest and Fish Settlement Agreement Adaptive Management Changes this morning. My organization worked very closely and very hard with partners in the state and the timber industry and the tribes on that deal, and we are pleased to see it coming to one piece of culmination today, so thank you. With regard to the northern spotted owls, WEC has been involved since the early 70s in working for sustainable forestry on state and private lands. And as you've heard already today, unfortunately, this is one place where we still have some more work to do with regard to this key indicator species for the health of our older forests. I think the northern spotted owl implementation team was scoped correctly in looking at both incentives and what might need to be done with additional regulatory screens or tools. And I wanted to share with you the context in which we're viewing this, which is similar to the sort of dual charge of the implementation team. The Washington Environmental Council, our board, in June adopted a new body of work called the Evergreen Forest Agenda. It's one of our three major focus areas, which is aimed at bringing new revenue streams to private forest landowners for the ecosystem services that working, well-managed working forests provide: carbon storage, wildlife habitat, clean water. We think that incentives are important, and we need more of them to keep working forests working on the landscape in Washington. But they do need to be part of a balanced solution, and part of that balance involves a regulatory foundation that is adequate for the basic protection of these species. So I'm here today to encourage you to develop measures that fully consider spotted owl sites and habitat, both inside and outside of the spotted owl special emphasis areas. There's clearly a gap there that the implementation team was meant to address and to come forward with suggestions on, and it feels like soon that conversation will be brought to the board unresolved, and it will be really important for this board to engage with that challenge and see what some of the solutions might look like. I would say that having been involved with these issues for nearly 20 years in Washington, when you look at the number of acres at stake here at this point in history, it's a smaller scale issue than forests and fish, than the 60,000 acres of stream network in Washington that are part of the forest and fish deal. And I hope that we can all, I think there are some real opportunities for collaboration going forward. I think with climate change and the way that our state is changing and the forest economy is changing, there are more opportunities for collaboration than there ought to be sort of getting high-centered on conflict. And given the scale of what's at stake here, it's very, very important, but it shouldn't be something that hangs us up for 5 years and gets us stuck. When there are ways that I think we could find some smart tools, put them in place, and move on to some of the bigger opportunities we have to work together. And WEC is committed to doing that. We're putting skin in that game on the incentives and ecosystem services side, and I would certainly encourage you all in this board to equally kind of meet us there with a package of both regulatory tools and incentives that get through this and hopefully allow us to work on some of these larger opportunities going forward. Thank you.
Thanks. Miguel Perez Gibson.
Hey friends, I'm Miguel Perez Gibson, speaking as a forestry consultant for Washington Environmental Council. I just got a couple, three pages, not very long. And I just thought the focus should really be on you all. And I'm going to bring out some dates, and if you just write those dates down, I think it'll simplify a lot of the concerns you hear in this room. And I brought my banjo because it was starting to feel to me like I've been doing this so long. Burns movie. I feel like we should be looking at black and whites and reading letters. So this is the trials and tribulations of Northern Spotty. He was becoming scarce in the 1980s. I was trudging across some deep brush along the Hood Canal and stopped. I could feel something staring right at me. My head turned a couple inches and nose to beak, his dark, trusting eyes were staring right at me. He said he was fledged and needed a new territory. Came over from the Olympic Peninsula. I said, sorry, Spotty, but school needs money. These trees are going down. So he just flew off. So fast forward a few decades. I was working on the forest plan and result of the settlement between Seattle Audubon and Sutherland. So you guys, on July 2008, write that down, pins up, 2008, your Forest Practices Board under Commissioner Sutherland established a Forest Practice Working Group, and the purpose was to measure the results and strategic contributions from non-federal lands that Washington could make to the conservation of Northern Spotted Owl. Well, days flew off the calendar like in a movie. You know. And finally, a year later, you can write this down, 2009, after a lot of scratching and whining and conniving and thinking and winking, finally, through all the politics necessary, that group was formed. Everybody in this room was on that group, by the way. They don't know you well, but we all know each other really well. And finally, that group was formed to make a recommendation and coordinate interactions with federal agencies around barred owl research. Then in 2010, you created a technical service group to create a roadmap, that's 2010, write that down, identifies actions that should be made to conserve the owl on non-federal lands. That was 3 years later. Now you have a new set of recommendations that we still fall short. The real action needs to take place on the ground. So I've got to pause and go back to the forest where Spotty is under that Forest Practices Board law that exists today. And if he creates a nest tree outside of a SOCI, what happens? I'll tell you what happens. He's got a 6-month lease. Starts in March, ends in July. About the best 70 acres of habitat around that tree he can sit and look at and enjoy, but after that, his apartment lease is up. And he's got to go because this law, your law, allows that all that to be cut down. And they don't even have to go through CEPA. So my final thought to you is that we've been at this table for almost a decade, and we know the drill of more reports and recommendations, but sooner or later, something's got to be done. And it may be it's time for us to get together with the Fish and Wildlife Commission and others to petition for a real rule, noting the loss of historic spotted owl territory that's been lost over the last decade. So you can fool some of the people all the time and all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. Abraham Lincoln said that. Put a bird on a banjo, I said that.
Glad we got TBW here. Posterity. With that, I'd like Andy Hayes and Lauren Burns to join us. We've got about 10 minutes or so of discussion in the form of a brief PowerPoint presentation on status of recommendations from the implementation team. Then we've got more discussion and action on the status of those recommendations at this point in time.
They didn't bring their instruments.
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the board. My name is Andy Hayes. I'm working at DNR's policy office. I have with me Lauren Burns, who's the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team Coordinator. We're very pleased to bring you an update today about the implementation team's work. A little bit chagrined that Mr. Perez Gibson has already taken up half of our presentation by going through the history, but nonetheless, we're going to present it in a slightly less artistic manner. Lauren's going to talk some on the, so a little bit of background for those of you to remind you sort of where we've been and, you know, how we're here, and I'm going to give you an update on the team's work.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Lauren Burns. As Andy said, I'm the NSOIT coordinator. Again, I regret I do not have a banjo, but we've assembled a visually stunning PowerPoint.
The Burns style.
So, just as a quick overview, I'll be explaining the policy working group to present, the Northern Spotted Owl implementation team work plan, as well as refreshing board members. Memory on what that November 2012 board motion is and how that will play into draft recommendations and next steps, which Andy will go over. So the Northern Spotted Owl Policy Working Group, in 2008, the Forest Practices Board unanimously adopted a motion establishing this group. The goal of the policy working group is to achieve strategic contributions from non-federal lands to the conservation of a viable population of northern spotted owls in Washington state. So in February 2010, the Northern Spotted Owl Policy Working Group presented their final report to the Forest Practices Board. The report included 7 consensus recommendations and 3 non-consensus recommendations. The board unanimously adopted a motion at that meeting, which directed the NSOIT to develop a work plan and prioritization for implementation of the consensus recommendations of the policy working group, coordinate with the federal agencies with regard to the barred owl control experiments, and convene a technical team to assess the spatial and temporal allocation of conservation efforts on non-federal lands using best available science. So board members have already received an updated work plan as well as a staff update in their packet, so I won't read through all of these work plan items, but you can see that we have several work plan items in progress, such as incentives, coordinating with regard to the barred owl control experiments, the decertification process for owl sites, that process has been completed, investigating whether we can conduct 2 pilot projects for fitting in habitat. I'll include an update later in my presentation on that, as well as the largest chunk of our effort to date, which is convening the technical team to assess spatial and temporal allocation of conservation efforts. That is currently in progress, and happy to say it's been making substantial progress lately. So, as a quick refresher, back in November 2012, the board, in addition to the charter duties from February 2010, and in accordance with the approved charter, the NSRT was further directed to investigate and make recommendations to the board not later than the August 2013 board meeting as to whether the state should consider voluntary opt-in federal assurances for forest landowners designed to promote the establishment, use, and operation of a Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Bank or other voluntary conservation incentive planning tools, or a programmatic habitat conservation plan, safe harbor agreement, or other federal assurances mechanisms. In addition, there were some other requirements within this motion. The NSRT recommendation shall, at a minimum, include an evaluation of the process, planning requirements, time and costs, both upfront and ongoing, required to secure and maintain such assurances, an evaluation of forest landowners' interest in enrolling with such programs, the degree to which achieving the NSOIT charter purpose and duties may be enhanced by securing such assurances, and the degree to which such assurances and planning structures would support the NSO conservation in light of the Washington State Forest Practices Rules, the Northwest Forest Plan, the 2012 Federal NSO Recovery Plan, and released 2012 critical habitat designation. So just a quick note on NSOIT membership expansion. Prior to the November 2012 board meeting, we had DNR chaired by Aaron Everett on the team, David Whipple serving as the DFW representative. We had Kevin Cott, Boo for Weyerhaeuser, Sean Cantrell for Seattle Audubon, and a land trust, Bettina Von Hagen. At that time, Paula Sweeting and Cindy Mitchell were providing support to conservation and industry, respectively. Following the expansion of the duties of the NSOIT in November 2012, we expanded that to have two state reps, two industry reps, two conservation reps, small forest landowner representative, and a land trust, as well as Fish and Wildlife Service, but they're participating in a less official role. So the new membership, David Whipple recently, as you may know, is no longer on the NSOIT, so membership changes are delineated by asterisks and italics. Chris Lipton was formerly serving as the industry representative, and Paul Sweeting is now the conservation representative, and we also have Vic Musselman as the small forest landowner representative. Cindy Mitchell is providing support to industry as well, and Andy and I are supporting the team. So moving into project updates, as I said, the priority of the team, aside from the November 2012 motion, is to get this technical team process complete, as well as investigating our East Side pilot project. And then Andy will discuss the NSOIT draft recommendations. So just as a quick refresher on what this technical team process is, since it was noted a little bit in public comment earlier, the NSOIT drafted a charter for the technical team back in 2011. The pace was reliant mostly on the release of the Northern Spotted Owl Recovery Plan, as well as Critical Habitat Rule, which was released later in 2012. The NSOIT jointly selected biologists and economists to participate, providing technical expertise, acknowledging that they are derived from different policy spheres. The NSOIT asked the team to analyze and recommend non-federal lands capable of providing a strategic contribution to spotted owl populations through voluntary conservation measures. These results must be scaled to achieve meaningful conservation benefit and must consider investments that are feasible and represent an economically efficient approach to incenting conservation measures. So the biologist would be providing the science and the economist would be providing the economic expertise. So a quick note on membership. We have Carl Halupka for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Elaine Reinbeck for U.S. Forest Service, Joby Cannon from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Gina King from Yakima Nation Wildlife, Tony Melchers for Weyerhaeuser, and Carl Whitaker for the Washington Forest Law Center. Our economists, not representing any particular organization, Ernie Meany, Dave Irvin, James Pittman, and Sarah Cruz. Just like to take a little point of personal privilege to express sincere gratitude to all of the work that our biologists and economists have been putting in for the past year or two on our technical analysis. It's absolutely critical to completing the work of the NSOIT, and several of the work plan objectives are heavily reliant on the results of this technical team process. So all of the effort that our biologists have put into addressing this board motion is sincerely appreciated. So in addition, I'd like to also thank Dave LaPlante from Natural Resources Geospatial and Jeffrey Dunk from Humboldt State University. We were able to contract them to assist the technical team in modifying the critical habitat model, which is explained in Appendix C of the recovery plan, as well as highlighted in the Federal Register notice for the critical habitat rule. Without their help and basically telling us how we can augment the model appropriately to effectively and efficiently answer our state level questions, it would be a much more arduous lift. So further on the technical team, they were asked to investigate the use of the Fish and Wildlife Service models utilized for the 2012 Critical Habitat Rule. These modeling tools assess the demographic response to specific critical habitat alternatives and represents best available science as we know it. The analytical approach, just a high-level overview at this point, we would be establishing baseline conditions on both federal and non-federal lands for NSO habitat and demographic response against which future conservation scenarios can be prepared. These future conservation scenarios represent proposed areas of focus for voluntary landowner conservation measures. So this is a three-phase project. We just completed phase one, which is developing baseline scenarios, and on July 26th, the technical team presented their baseline modeling results to the NSOIT for feedback. This Friday, the technical team will also present their draft conservation scenarios to the NSOIT, which puts us into phase two. Phase three will be completing the modeling of the conservation scenarios. And progress overall has been very steady with the assistance of contractors to provide technical expertise and assist with model development. The modeling development continues, and the tech team is interacting regularly with the NSOIT for guidance. It's anticipated that the technical team analysis will be completed by this fall. So a couple quick notes on the East Side Pilot Project. Back in 2010, along with the consensus recommendations from the Policy Working Group, there were two pilot projects, both for the East Side and the West Side. There was a pilot rule approved by the board in 2010, which allowed for the for this pilot rule to be conducted on Longview Timber Lands within the INEAT SOC. So we convened a pilot working group of biologists. We explored several stands within INEAT and the Blewett areas. And the goal is to improve habitat while creating incentives for landowners to participate in habitat restoration. At this point, the pilot team is currently reviewing a stand analysis conducted by Longview Timber staff to determine the likely outcomes of various treatment options for one forest stand identified by the team. The NSOIT is also contemplating options for moving forward that acknowledge that these types of stands identified within the pilot rule do not exist in abundance. And the NSOIT is aiming to present results of the pilot to the board at its November 2013 board meeting. So with that, I'll transfer the mic over to Andy Hayes.
So Lauren's been giving you kind of an overview of what the existing tasks of the team were when it was established in 2010. She also indicated to you that last year in 2012, there was a board motion to amend that workload. And that has been really one of the primary focuses of the team since that board motion. We've been working hard on, as we continue to work on the technical team work, which is sort of an ongoing process, and work on the pilot, the team's been working diligently on the sort of investigation of opportunities for relative to federal assurances. And so the original board motion requested the team report back in August this month of this year. And that work has not been, agreement on those recommendations has not been fully realized at this point. But the team continues to work diligently towards the goal of reaching consensus by November of 2013. So what I would like to do, despite having fully formed recommendations, give you kind of an overview of where the team is right now. And I would say those recommendations, that work they've been doing, is sort of divided into two areas. The first is sort of elements that they've established some consensus on. And the second area are areas that are still in development. And so I'm going to give a sort of a high-level overview of those two categories. So under elements of consensus, there are really three main sort of consensus items. The first is the need to pursue new and substantial funding sources to support effective incentive tools. The second is recognizing the need to deploy a diversity of tools to address the spectrum of voluntary conservation commitments that are possible out there. And lastly, the need to acknowledge the continued pursuit of these voluntary conservation measures that the team has been engaging in is going to require ongoing staff and resources to continue that work. So, related to back to the substantial funding sources, the first sort of recommendation is that sort of an overarching recommendation that really acknowledges the fact that one way to maximize conservation in important ways through this sort of bundling or stacking of ecosystem service values. The team recommends that voluntary conservation proposals and existing funding sources be inclusive of broad ecosystem service values that are also beneficial to owls. And this is based, in part on feedback from private and nonprofit entities that have been working in habitat and land conservation. And in their view, projects that are most successful seek to incorporate these multiple ecosystem service values to leverage adequate funding to assure project success. The team has been looking at some proposals for conservation funding, and so they have sort of developed in concept three sort of funding options as proposals to move forward. The first is conceptually is a B&O business and occupation tax credit trading, which is explicitly linked to a conservation bank. And in this option, the legislature would pass a bill that could allow large manufacturers to forego paying a portion of their B&O tax on sales in exchange for funding a conservation bank, essentially to conserve northern spotted owl habitat. The second option he's been looking at is sort of a variant on that, which is a B&O tax credit trading, a working force conservation easement B&O credit trading scenario. And that would be similar to the first option one, but in this scenario, it would allow businesses to invest in working force conservation easements in exchange for a tax forbearance. The third option that they've been looking at is the possibility of a bond measure for conservation. This would provide additional funding to conservation projects benefiting either directly or indirectly the northern spotted owl. The statewide conservation bond measures have been successful in other states and would require, of course, a large and politically cohesive coalition in order to achieve something like that. Related to the second and third elements of consensus, employing a diversity of tools to address a spectrum of voluntary conservation commitments really acknowledges the fact that that incentive solutions may come in the form of diverse tools that utilize unique conservation commitments and different lengths of term, essentially, of commitment. And so those might include outright fee purchase, permanent easements, term agreements like safe harbor agreements, landowner option plans, etc. And then sort of more prescription-based management activities, which is really about a sort of a once-off management activity. And then lastly, the team feels strongly about the need for ongoing work related to this, and acknowledges that when the work of the implementation team ends, the work of finding voluntary incentives will not end. And so their recommendation is to support the establishment of a DNR staff position that's dedicated to pursuing an ongoing pursuit of these opportunities and funding sources as its primary focus. So the second set of considerations being made by the implementation team are not elements of consensus this time. They're continuing to work on them, but I want to give you a sort of a high-level overview of some of the concepts they've been working on. The first is sort of an overarching theme, which is the possibility that conservation banking holds, the promise that it holds for as a tool in conservation. the implementation team believes that there's the potential to establish a conservation bank for spotted owl habitat on private lands. However, there's a lot of uncertainty around that type of proposal. And there's currently neither a northern spotted owl conservation bank in existence nor guidelines on the establishment of one. So there are a variety of challenges to this sort of approach. Then the team's also looking at a number, sort of three options as outlined here, the first being a programmatic HCP with a conservation bank. Under this scenario, there'd be a programmatic habitat conservation plan developed for non-federal lands that would be subject to the forest practices rules. Participation would require landowners to make a conservation commitment, details of which would be determined by negotiation with the Fish and Wildlife Service. In exchange, their land manager would be protected from associated incidental take associated incidental take permit. That would, in turn, allow for the creation of a bank in which landowners creating or protecting habitat in areas of greater conservation significance could protect habitat and create a bank credit that then could be sold, allowing harvest of areas of habitat that are less significant to the long-term persistence of the species. So that's the first option. Second option under consideration is the use of a voluntary opt-in safe harbor agreement with incentives. Under this scenario, the department would facilitate the development of a programmatic SHA, safe harbor agreement, for Fish and Wildlife Service, with Fish and Wildlife Service for non-federal lands. That would provide sort of a standardized process to establish a habitat baseline for ownership on the part of landowners. It would be a voluntary participation. And then once enrolled, landowners would have federal take assurances and would have safe harbor to grow habitat, which then could be incentivized through a variety of programs to support that habitat development. And the last option being considered, option three, is the notion of a programmatic hybrid habitat conservation plan and safe harbor agreement sort of concept. The department would pursue a development and approval of a federal assurance tool that really hybridized some elements of both of those. It would authorize habitat banking as one financial incentive tool and would also provide regulatory streamlining by making federal assurances available to landowners wishing to use active management to improve spotted owl habitat on their lands. And this option includes sort of both mandatory and voluntary opt-in components to it. Another sort of overarching consideration being made by the implementation team right now is this concept of barred owl management. And it really surrounds this notion of whether the state should consider whether a programmatic federal assurance should include barred owl management as a conservation tool. It's likely that at this point it's currently undetermined. The feds have completed an EIS and are pursuing a study of this topic exactly about barred owl management. So we're a little ahead of the game with that here. But it is expected and likely that some level of barred owl maintenance control might be necessary to assist in conservation efforts. And so this option being considered sort of reflects that idea. So as I said before, the team is recommending to the board that they continue their work on the evaluation of federal assurances. Based on this evaluation and the body of work completed, they'd like to continue work, they think, into the fall. November is the date that they're shooting for. Many of these policy options that we've been discussing, particularly the ones that we don't have consensus on, the reason there's not consensus because these are complicated options. They're forward-looking, and they're really dependent on some of these results around some of the technical outcomes of the technical team's work, the sort of economic information and feasibility, and landowner interest, which is all information that we're continuing to generate and hope to do in the next couple months. It's the team's perspective that completion of these assessments would allow the board to be fully informed about making its own evaluation.
Thanks, Andy. My hope as chairing this group was that you would have a written interim report product, at least a day or something in advance of this meeting. You don't, and that results from last-minute gyrations around document content, as sometimes happens. That being as it is, I think I can express the sentiment of the team that between the continuing quantitative work around modeling habitat scenarios and the need to inform further board decisions with that information, as well as the landowner interest and economic feasibility and some of these other sort of material things to how the board may wish to proceed on this subject are as yet not fully formed. That's why I support the recommendation we do need to do this with a motion if we choose to do it. That's why I support the recommendation to allow the team to continue its work and to functionally extend the timeline for their performance until the November 2013 meeting. But I want to offer, we've all been working on this an awfully long time, as the public commenters noted, and I want to offer the board a chance to ask questions and have some discussion around this issue.
You were expecting that, weren't you?
I see that one coming.
I wanted to make a couple of comments, maybe just to set the context a little bit for the discussion, and then it would be great to have lots of questions, if possible, from board members. So, first thing I wanted to say is that there's been a lot of creative thinking and genuine interest in developing incentive tools that work. And so that's been a great part of the OWL implementation team's work. There's been some open-mindedness and good thinking, and you know, those consensus agreements are important, and I think they form the basis of good work going forward. And then I also wanted to just note that the talk about incentives and payment for ecosystem services is something that environmental community as a whole in Washington State, and I would even say nationwide, has been sinking significant resources into the last, decade, but certainly in a very focused way in the last 5 or 6 years. So lots of investment in financial capital and philanthropic capital in, people spending, their days and nights and evenings and weekends thinking about how to do this on carbon markets and payment for watershed services and habitat banking and all that kind of stuff. So when you hear recommendations or when you hear suggestions about incentives, it's not an empty promise. It's people have been thinking about it for a long time. It's not easy to come up with funding. It's not easy to come up with the methods that work. But I think, as one of the commenters said, there's skin in the game here. So that's a genuine offer on the table. One of the other things I wanted to note is that I think that out there in the world, there is a sense that the spotted owl has caused a great amount of economic harm and fear. And one of the things I just wanted to point out is to kind of put some context around the numbers I heard from some of the public commenters. I think one of the numbers cited was there's 2.1 million acres of SOCES. But the regulations, our rules, put a class 4 special trigger on forests that meet spotted owl habitat definition as described in the board when the habitat is within documented owl territories. So that number is actually far lower than 2.1 million acres. And my best estimate, a little bit back of the envelope, and somebody can try to come up with a more precise one, but based on public information, I would venture to say that that restricts about 1% or less of private forest lands in the state of Washington. I think there's no more than 80,000 acres of suitable spotted owl habitat in circles in SOCES. So this rule does not put massive restrictions on forest management in the state, and I think that's important to remember. And just the third quick point for context is the hard part of our discussion, the part that's really difficult to reach consensus and it's understandable, is that there's owl sites and habitat outside of the rule right now, outside of SOCES. And it's been a long-standing concern in the environmental community, and it's kind of the central point of where we can get wrapped around the axle is what do you do with that? And some of these proposals deal with federal assurances around that. Right now, our rules allow harvest of habitat in occupied territories outside of SOCES. Endangered Species Act doesn't allow that. So purely from a public policy perspective, I would like to ask this board to consider whether or not it's a good idea to have a set of rules that have that difference. So any owl that lands someplace outside of SOC has no protection from our rules. And our rules sanction the loss of that habitat. So it's I think something, I mean, it's going to be the central difficult policy issue that we have to grapple with.
Other questions for
the group? I'm coming up a learning curve here, but so how long do we have? I mean, what's the loss rate of spotted owls? What did the federal studies say this last year? How many years are we going to have spotted owls with the way things are right now?
I think the best information we've got about that is from the federal demographic study areas. I understand the rate of loss is about 7% a year. That was cited in one of the...
So 7% a year, so 20 years, 15 years. And what do we know about, again, I'm just trying to get some context. What do we know about, what would $100 million and $100 million capital dollars anticipated or contemplated in one of those recommendations? What would that do for us to the 15 or 20 years? Do we have any sense of scale there?
Yeah, so I think that's one of the values of the modeling work that's ongoing. It's difficult to say that you could feasibly target a tangible population benefit in a particular place without going through some exercise that tells you, you know, what population response is likely to be the changes in habitat availability. And so whether you want to approach it from a conservation focus standpoint or an incentive development standpoint, if any of us together are going to go over and make a successful case to the legislature or any other potential funding source, you do need that basis for it, because otherwise you have people ask the very question you just asked and you don't have a good answer for it. It's hard to be successful.
So in November, when we're presented these recommendations, we'll have some context around the so what with each of them. I mean, will it be able to discuss the effectiveness and the ease of implementation and the cost to the landowners and all of that?
That's the intent of the modeling as far as quantifying the cost. You know, we were thinking about, from a technical approach to it, ways to run that through some kind of optimization model. It doesn't look like that's particularly feasible, but I think we can quantify the absolute value of different conservation scenarios from a land and timber standpoint. So we'll get an idea of scale and sideboards and efficacy, most important.
So I'm just adding on to what Joe is asking, and it has to do with, you mentioned meaningful conservation benefits. We're only talking about a fragment of the landscape where we're looking at population dynamics across the landscape, and here we're just talking about a small piece, potentially. And so, relatively small compared to like the federal forest lands and others. And so when you talk about meaningful conservation benefits within the purview of this board, have there been discussions about what that means? Because in your slide, you do talk about meaningful conservation benefits, and is that part of what the implementation team will be doing?
So I think I can take a crack at that. So one of the things that this tool, this modeling tool we've been using, and we didn't get into great depth about it, but it allows you to see, put different conservation networks, they call them essentially, but conservation commitments on the landscape, and you can get a sense for what the demographic response to that is. And so what we're using the tool to do is to look at, starting from baseline conditions, build sort of increasing conservation commitments around those, and to see what happens to owl demographics. And it, you know, all landscapes may not be created equal in terms of their capability to create, you know, viable populations, contribute to a viable population of owls. And so one of the things we're trying to do is to look at increasing conservation commitments in different parts of the landscape and see how owl demographics respond. And that will give us a sense of magnitude of change. You know, what sort of landscape do you have to get to 10,000 acres or 50,000 acres or more before you get a sense of whether there's actually, you can see sort of a blip, if you will, on the owl demographics. That having been said, this model looks at, as did critical habitat, looks at sort of the suitability of that landscape to create owls. It doesn't really give us absolute number of owls that it's creating. So it's sort of an index that allows you to see, okay, you know, proportionality, and especially good for comparing among alternatives. And so that's what we're going to be using it for.
Other questions for the team? Run over a little bit of time.
Quick question.
Sure.
So at and this is because I'm not real familiar with the specifics of the debate, but at what point do the feds come in and say, okay, you guys have failed, now we're going to do something?
Are you asking me?
I'm just curious, and then what is the consequence?
I think that's a really difficult question to answer. The conversations that we've attempted to have with the feds is got a letter on critical habitat as an example of how they view the intersection of state rules with their responsibility to implement the Endangered Species Act. So you can kind of tell from the nature of that letter and the nature of the decision that they had to make in critical habitat that that's a, you know, it's sort of a complex interaction. No small wonder to anybody that the litigation that originated this series of dialogues asked that very question. The settlement of the litigation averted answering it specifically in that context.
The only reason I ask it is because it's really, it's like you make a decision in a vacuum. You really don't understand what the consequences are.
Yeah, so the states, well, we could probably work up some legal advice for board members on the interaction between state rules and the Federal Endangered Species Act if that's something that the AG's office would be willing to share with board members, is a bit more legal advice when we come to that point.
I just wanted to give a little bit of context, I think, in terms of the way the discussions with the Fish and Wildlife Service have been going in our team. I get the sense that they would really like us to solve the problem. You know, they haven't expressed a desire to be heavy-handed or interventionist, and are happy to work with us, especially around federal assurances, if we can come up with a proposal that has that has legs and a likelihood of success. Our team is actually cited, I think, both in the recovery plan and the critical habitat rule as a sort of innovative, creative way to try to deal with issues on non-federal lands. So, I think in the absence of some sort of comprehensive federal assurances, then they'll continue to deal with private landowners the way they're dealing with them now, which is on an individual basis. And it, you know, there's questions of risk to landowners, and I think that the main gist of a lot of the proposals we've been coming up with is to try to remove that risk and make it so, to the extent possible, landowners can manage their land the way they want to without worrying about take liability, and or if they want to take advantage of incentives and grow new habitat, they also have operational certainty around doing that. So that's I think more the context in which we're involving the service at this point.
Thanks. Other questions for the team? So we have an action item to decide on, and that is whether to accept the recommendation and authorize the team to continue conducting this expanded portion of its work and report back to the board at the November 2013 meeting. I'd like this, so as usual, we have a draft motion for the board's consideration on the board. More specifically than what that says, I would like the completion of an interim report by no later than the end of next week. And I feel that it's important that the board gets a written product on where things stand and that you have adequate time to look at and consider where we are. As I said at the outset, we were fairly close to getting that completed in advance of the meeting, but it didn't get across the finish line, and I'd like to distribute it to the board as soon as possible.
Next week or next this week?
You want a calendar date?
Well, this week, the 16th, isn't it? Or if you want it next Friday, then I think
it's 23rd. So that'd be seven more days.
I just don't know which one you want.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, next, the Friday after that.
So we have a person willing to make this motion, or do I need to carry it? I'd be happy to do that.
Go right ahead.
I will so move. I move the Forest Practices Board allow the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team until November 2013 to complete developing recommendations as assigned by the Board at the November 2012 meeting. In addition, an interim report be completed by August 23rd, 2013 and distributed to the boards. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you. Motion made and seconded. Discussion on the motion?
No.
Hearing none. Call the question. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Thank you all very much. I think, in closing, I haven't been grinding away on this as nearly as long as anybody else who's been involved with it. I share a strong desire to bring some resolution to this, and thought we took a shot at it. And I think we still got a good shot at it, and we're going to push hard as a team to get something back to the board that looks like it moves the ball down the field now. I predict that it satisfies everyone, because we never seem to be able to do that. But didn't know what surprise. But I don't want the motion to pass thinking that the chair is content with this drag on internally. So our next item of business, and thank you for your indulgence on running a little bit long. Thank you, Lauren, and thank you, Andy.
This has nothing to do with this.
Okay.
Is to take up the Is to take up the Forest Practices Hydraulic Project for biomass rulemaking. Consideration of final action on adoption of rule.
Chair and members of the board. Today I'm requesting that you adopt the Forest Practices Hydraulic Project and Forest Biomass Rules. I kind of sigh. It's been a very long process, very detailed. I'm going to be briefer in the actually recounting of all the changes in the rule. However, you do have a sheet within your packet that I will go through for the record. And I believe that the board discussion after my presentation will probably result in an addressing of any concerns or issues about the draft rules that you have before you. As you know, in 2012 legislation, Senate Bill 6406 directed the board to incorporate fish protection standards from the hydraulic code rules into the forest practice rules. In addition, we've linked up because we have several common rules. The board accepted recommendations from the Forest Biomass Working Group on several rule changes, so they've been linked together into this one moment. At the May meeting, you directed staff to file the rule language for public review. And the board's motion included two options for consideration for the definition of bank full width, and two options for consideration for the definition of the Forest Practices Hydraulic Project. These rules were published in the State Register on June 5th, and we held two public hearings. I now have the dates in front of me, I forgot earlier. On June 27th in Ellensburg, and on the 29th here in Olympia. Again, the comment period ended on June 30, and the board received a considerable range of comments from 24 commenters, many about the definition options. As a result of the comments and concerns that staff had heard from both the board and the commenters, staff revisited and carefully looked at the intent of the legislature in 6406. And we come up with the following recommendations, and then I'll expand a little bit here after I do things. The first is that we recommend including the type N waters in the definition of forest practices hydraulic project. That we maintain the current requirements to use bank foot width as they exist in the forest practice rules, and that we bring back and include the requirements for the use of ordinary high water line as that definition is incorporated in the hydraulic code. So those rules in the hydraulic code that you're bringing into the forest practices rules, where they use the metric ordinary high water line, they will be incorporated in the forest practices rules. And then the third thing is to make changes to the initial language in the class 2 definition, so class 2 forest practices. We think it's important to include type N waters in a definition of forest practices hydraulic project to maintain common terminology for all projects that use, divert, obstruct, or change the natural flow or bed of forested streams. Many of the comments highlighted the potential increased requirements for landowners for projects in type N waters resulting from the inclusion of type N. So in response, staff has modified a number of rules clarifying how the requirements for the forest practice hydraulic projects are specific to type S and F waters, and in some instances associated NP. We decided not to recommend changing the definition of bank foot width, again, because of specific direction given in the legislature. However, the current used bank foot width is currently used as the rules give direction towards type N waters. And as I said earlier, where the hydraulic code uses ordinary high water line, we continue to use that. This does create a situation where forest practice rules contain two different stream metrics, but for all forest practice applications, the landowner must determine if a stream is an S, an F, or an N before they design the project. Once determined, the appropriate metric, bank foot width or ordinary high water line, will be applied. The changes we recommend to Class 2 are reflected in the language before you that you've got in your packet. We believe these changes will eliminate confusion over what kind of forest practice hydraulic projects can be classified as Class 2 forest practices. The draft rules remove the statement that any operation requiring a hydraulic project approval cannot be a Class 2 from the first paragraph under Class 2. This maintains the concept that forest practice application renewals are Class 2, and all operations currently listed as a Class 2 will continue to be that. As I mentioned earlier, there are some corrections that we believe that we need to point out to you. They're contained on the sheet that was in your packet. However, on one, I believe the Department of Ecology may need to weigh in, and you'll see when I get there. The first is on page 5 in 222.16.010. This is the very large rule that contains all of the definitions within the forest practices rules. For forest practice, as you will see, the change here is to state that means any activity conducted on or directly pertaining to forest land and related to growing, harvesting, or processing timber, or removing forest biomass, including but not limited to. This is directly as it pertains to biomass. It's for emphasis, and it offers clarity as to where biomass fits in within the definition of forest practice activity. The next thing change is in 222.16.010 again, 16031. Ordinary high water line is in what is currently in the forest practices rule. The definition is for the ordinary high water mark. Staff recommends striking the word mark and inserting the word line. This will be consistent with the definition as brought forward from the hydraulic code.
And then in 031, and this is where the college may want to weigh in, for a type 1 water, it means all waters within the ordinary high water mark. That's in current rule. Staff recommends striking mark and inserting the word line. On page 25, in 222.24.041, sub 2, improved forest practice application is required for construction structural work and maintenance associated with any bridge structure. At the end of that statement, we had inserted within bank full width of the stream. Staff recommends we incorporate the language as it is in the hydraulic code, which is states waterward of the ordinary high water line. This all of the language here is language brought over from the hydraulic code. Where we had first recommended bank full width, we now want to incorporate the language of the code. And finally, on page 57, under 223060 for deadfalls, we recommend a change to remove without hydraulic project approval from the Department of Fish and Wildlife and insert except with approval by the department. And on this one, I'd like to refer you to the comment. This gives the reason why we're recommending the change. I want to thank Gretchen for all her incredible work. And as she states, we've determined that restricting this approval to an approved FPA does not allow for unexpected or previously unknown circumstances that may occur during the course of a project. We recommend the language be changed as shown here, except with approval by the department. This offers that flexibility. And the final thing, and I fully expect that there'll be quite a conversation, so I'll just keep pushing through. Our final request is that the board make the effective date of the adopted rules as December 30th of 2013. The reason is to allow time for our ops folks, Donnell's side of the shop, to conduct, to prepare and conduct training for staff, including wildlife bios and landowners, for all of the forms to be fully developed, and you know, in general, for people to be prepared for the implementation of these rules. Also, December 30th is important because the legislation specified a deadline of December 31st, that everything had to be done by that date. So we backed it up by one day. As you will hear after this agenda item, we will go into all of the associated board manuals. I failed to state earlier that the Adaptive Management Program Reform rulemaking also involves the change, I guess I did, manual amendment. The legislation for this rule required the board to approve an associated board manual offering guidance for the implementation of the Forest Practice Hydraulic Project Program. In addition to that, we have a number of existing board manuals which right now reference the acquisition of an HPA. We've changed that language to the requirement for a forest practice hydraulic project approval as part of a forest practice application. So in closing, I request the board adopt the proposed rules along with the corrections that I've described. So at this time, I'd be happy to entertain any questions or board discussion.
Tom?
Thanks, Mark. This has been quite an effort, and things, you know, still learning stuff about what's in front of us, because it is pretty complex. And I do understand the legislative constraints that we had coming into this. I really appreciate all the caucuses' work on this and all the staff work that went into trying to make these things match up, and it's not perfect. And I understand from the response to comments, the responsiveness summary, that you know we're kind of looking at work down the road that we're going to have to do in future rulemaking. So I appreciate that. It gives me some confidence about moving forward with this package. I have one point of clarification I want to ask you about, because there's a couple things in here coming over from the hydraulics rule language that is quite different from what we have in forest practices. And I want to just be clear that we're not really changing some of our core practices. So this question is about the expectations around delivery of sediment, you know, to water bodies. We have in the rule package a couple places, like maybe three or four. Like I'm looking at the one right now under bridge construction, where it says that disturbed areas shall be protected from erosion within 7 days of completion, which is a long time to if you're having any kind of sediment delivery going on. And my understanding is that this would not change our current practice on responding to sediment delivery. I just wanted to get clarification from you on that.
Yeah, that is correct. The code holds that kind of an ultimate form of erosion control be in place within 7 days. However, there is no tolerance for delivery to any live water, even during the construction. So, you know, most projects occur in the dry season now. However, if, for example, some weather were to come in, it would be expected that the landowner and operator would take measures to control potential delivery. The DNR maintains its full regulatory toolbox, and forest practice foresters will work with landowners, and that we will take appropriate action to assure that delivery does not occur. This does not compromise in any way our ability to assure no delivery.
Thank you.
Along those lines, Mark, and I echo Tom, it's a fantastic job watching you go through this, and hats off to you. But along those lines, and I guess we did have a concern that can be addressed at a later date, is that it'd really help, and I'd urge DNR to clarify, especially on bridge maintenance, what requires FPA and what should just be a class one forest practice. So just urge you to work through that in the future.
Are you talking about what level of activity rises to the need for
if we're sweeping a bridge off,
yes,
doesn't require a hydraulic permit or pulling weeds,
yeah,
compared with sandblasting wood.
Yeah.
Mark, I want to go back to the changes, the page on changes, and just make sure I understand that correctly. Are these in response to comments? Sorry. These are in response to comments, or these are things that have been noted subsequent to comment period?
These are, this particular page are things that we have found since the comment period, as we have reviewed and re-reviewed and reviewed yet again. The staff, this is a very large rulemaking, and the manner in which the hydraulic code is written is significantly different than the manner in which the forest practice rules have been written. And so there's been a lot of effort, time and effort put into allowing a new set of rules to be incorporated within the forest practice rules. And you know, every time you read it, you see little things here and there. But I believe that we've really covered the rules in very significant detail. And although I will be the first to say that as the rules are implemented within time, there is a likelihood that issues will come up, such as Board Member Scanlon has pointed out, that we may need to look at and the board may need to refine in order to assure that the hydraulic code as it's been integrated within the rules is applied. The one kind of bottom line that we had is that we don't want there to be any dramatic change in the implementation of the fish protection standards through the hydraulic process than what's currently being applied to today. So the intent is that we continue to provide good protection for fish while allowing landowners the ability to gain application approval much like they are able to today.
Other questions for Mark? Hearing none. We have action to consider on final rulemaking for forced practices hydraulic projects. As this convention, we have a starting point for a motion up on the screen. Is there a board member willing to carry that motion?
I'll take a stab. I move the Forest Practice Board adopt the rule proposal as presented today that pursuant to Chapter 1, the laws of 2012 incorporates into the Forest Practice Rules fish protection standards from the hydraulic code rules applicable to forest practice activities and incorporates recommendations by the Forest Biomass Working Group related to the harvest of forest biomass. I further move that the board direct staff to file a CR 103 rulemaking order with the Office of the Code Revisor, specifying an effective date of December 30, 2013.
5 seconds. Mr. Storr, motion's been made and seconded. Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I call a question. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Thank you all very much. Motion carries.
I also want to thank you all very much.
Mark's owed a keg of beer. This was quite a long and involved process, both with this and the adaptive management program reform rulemaking. I can't express to board members and staff and the public how much work it is to have two consequential rulemakings up in the air at the same time. We're talking about two or three people that really put the major time into this and making sure that we've got an adequate public process, that we're responsive to it, that we get the rules right, and they really deserve our thanks and appreciation. So. We're not quite done yet. Next, we have public comments on the board manual sections associated with the rulemakings we've done today. Do I not have any?
Yes.
Oh, it's on the other side. Sorry. You're getting kind of tricky there with me, Patricia. Okay, so the first I have is Peter Heide. Pete's still in the room?
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the board again. And my name is Peter Heide, and I am indeed representing WFPA this time. First of all, I'll get to the point. WFPA would like to see you approve the board manual sections that are before you today regarding the forest practices hydraulic projects. So I want to say that this has been a long process, and we very much appreciate the way the department, both the Department of Natural Resources and Fish and Wildlife, have gone about this process. We think it seemed like it was getting started late, and I was skeptical that you would be able to get it done, but you did. So I think you have you owe staff a great thanks. And I'd like to extend Aaron's thank you a bit. And primarily, this is the group that worked on the board manual, but there's a couple of other staff people who have really contributed here in addition to Mark. In fact, I don't think Mark actually done it by himself. Gretchen Robinson is, it's sort of amazing to see what Gretchen was able to do by doing all the real hard work of getting the manual assembled, put together, and bringing drafts. I don't know how many meetings we had, twice a month, and she was able to get drafts out within a few days of the work, so we had a draft to work on, you know, 10 days later. And I pretty well understand that she was doing the same kind of thing with the rulemaking, and there were others probably involved. Mark Ratcliffe came on somewhere midway and put a huge amount of effort into the rulemaking, and he too deserves similar accolades that that the chair gave to the other Mark. There were a number of other people, though. Linda Hoffman with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm going to find everybody's name here, else I'll forget somebody. She was on the phone consistently, along with Tom Thorne from the Colville Tribe, listening to hours and hours of meetings over the phone, which has got to be almost impossible to do. We had Scott Rockwell from the, still Amish Tribe, and another fellow from, Mike Ollis, drove down for every meeting through Seattle traffic from Skagit, Stonewash County. It's just the amount of work, the effort that people put into this was tremendous. Terry Jackson did a great job with Fish and Wildlife, and Don Nauer, he put drafts in front of us, and that was the critical thing to have happen. We had to have something to work on. There were a number of other people, Jerry Johnson with DNR. We had three folks from the industry that helped me, Don Hsu with Weyerhaeuser, and Steve Barmeyer with Weyerhaeuser. Stephen Dillon with Hancock all brought good engineering knowledge into the room along with the other folks. Ecology contributed. Bob Pennell was carrying water for Ecology. Very good job. Chris Mendoza was there for the Conservation Caucus. So all these folks were contributing, I know, to the manual, and I'm sure, although we didn't have the same consensus process around the rulemaking as we did the manual, I'm sure they were all contributing individually to DNR. Lastly, I'd like to say that I don't believe that we have total consensus around the manual. I don't know, you may hear something later from this morning or this afternoon from others, but even though there wasn't total consensus, there was a tremendous amount of effort put in and continued contribution from everyone. So again, I want to thank everybody and thank you, the board, and hopefully you will adopt this or approve this manual. Thank you.
Thanks, Pete. I have Chris Mendoza signed up to testify to make public comment, but I don't see Chris in the room. So we will be moving on and ask Mark Ratcliffe to come join us. Hi, Mark.
Afternoon, Chair, members of the board. I'm Mark Ratcliffe, Forest Practices. So part of my job is overseeing the development of the manual, the board manual, revising amendments that may come up. So what I want to do today is outline how those changes and amendments have been made given the rule making that you heard earlier today. And thanks, Pete, for the nice words. So Mark outlined the adaptive management program and forest practice hydraulic rules, and I want to go through the manuals in those order, but also the four additional manuals that we needed amendments. And then later I'll be asking that you approve these with some minor, with permission for staff to do some minor changes before they get distributed. The first one is Section 2, Guidelines for the Adaptive Management Program. And certainly Mark outlined the changes that were done in the rules very well, so I won't go into that. But I did want to mention that the amendments in the manual incorporate the stakeholder process, the recommendations from that group. There were several meetings through July, and a lot of revisions going back and looking at the language, and also from consensus from policy as well.
The main changes I want to bring to your attention are we added a policy decision chart. It's on page 21. Looks like this. This is a flow chart that, in a sense, is a word picture. Okay, it's up on the screen. It shows how policy decision made through the dispute resolution process. We also, where policy road is referenced in the manual, and it's in hundreds of places, it now will be policy committee. Okay. And in Appendix A, which is the ground rules for how policy interacts and kind of the do's and don'ts, we added some wording, some elements to those ground rules that the settlement agreement group agreed on. And those have now been placed in the Appendix A, which is the ground rules. On this chart that's up, I do need to mention a change that is will be implemented in the board manual that you did not receive in your packet. And it's at the very bottom. We will be adding the word time extensions allowed by consensus based on substantial progress. Progress reports required at each monthly meeting. That version shows it there, and your version does not. We also changed where it has said by policy. We have added policy committee to be consistent. And at the very top right, where it said need a list of examples, we have scratched that and elected not to put examples. There are a few grammatical errors that we found, and we'll be changing those. A web link talking about CMR protocols directed people to the Adaptive Management Program web link, and that will be further on to direct them to CMR's web link. In some cases, we still need to add committee to the policy committee. Those are minor things that we can do in the back. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have regarding Section 22.
Doesn't sound like it.
Okay. Question, or are we going? Keep going.
We need to do some procedural standpoint. You need to do separate motions for each, or you do one for all?
Two.
Okay. So then, action item number one, is to consider approval of Section 22 of the Board Manual, which is up on the screen now as a deliberative draft for the Board's consideration. If someone is willing to carry this motion.
I'll read it. Board Manual Sections. I move the Forest Practices Board approve Board Manual Section 22, Adaptive Management Program. I further move that Board allow staff to make minor editorial changes if necessary prior to distribution.
Motion's been made. Do I have a second?
Second. Well, you can give it to Bill.
Board Member Little got in there, I think. Okay. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I call a question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say no. Any abstentions? All right. Proceed.
Okay. The next one will be the new Section 5 guidelines for forest practice hydraulic projects. The same legislation that certainly asked DNR to adopt the rules, asked DNR to provide the technical guidance to accompany, supplement those rules. The new board manual provides the technical guidance for S, F, and N water crossings. Some of the key aspects for Section 5 include we borrowed or used Fish and Wildlife's 2003 culvert design manual for a lot of the language and design parameters for culvert methods. We use some of the charts, some of the language, because the legislation said use what is currently being implemented. We use the word channel bed width as a starting point or a design parameter to begin with for that water crossing structure. And channel bed width, we've broken out to almost a whole page of what that means. There's lots of ways to describe a stream, as you can imagine. And so channel bed width is what we want people to start with for their project. That could mean bankful width. That could mean ordinary high water. It just depends on find what type of water you have and then determine what that width is, and then the design for that crossing will be dictated from that. As I mentioned, it may include bankful width or ordinary high wrapped into that definition. The water crossing structures for in waters was originally in Board Manual Section 3, and we have taken that and removed it from 3 and placed it into 5, the new 5, so that we then have a title, Board Manual title, that covers all water crossing structures, regardless of fish or non-fish. There is one minor correction I'd like to bring to your attention. It's on page 15. Under sediment transport and deposition, five lines down, I guess it is. Here we direct readers to get more information from the DNR's application website. That will be changed to direct readers to get more information from the resource list in the back of the manual. There's a couple few minor edits that we'd like your permission to do upon adoption of this manual. They have to do with, in certain ways and places, we need to italicize a definition. Generally in the board manuals, we italicize as you read through it if that word is defined later in the glossary. Any questions on 5 at this time?
The sum total of the changes are of that nature?
Yes.
Just italicizing?
They're italicizing. I can point out a few of them here to you. On page 5, no, I'm sorry, on page 6, in table 1, this is not italicizing, but you see a table in the second box, it says site, project site preparation is listed twice. That'll be listed once. Those kinds of non-content, non-substantive.
So we're talking about the whole section?
Well, yes. I will be going through the 4 additional, if you will, where changes are in the other section.
Are the other
sections?
Correct.
Question on 5.
So this was, I apologize for not having studied these all that well. But I just am looking at this one section. I'm wondering why it's even in here. It's on hydraulic design. It's on page 27. Okay. It's subsection is 4.5.2.3. If you read it, it looks like an option for designing culverts. But then it says really some pretty incredible things that it's... It's highly uncertain. It has a limited range of applicable settings. It may fail to provide passage for non-target species, and it's unlikely to achieve the objective of passing all fish species at all life stages. It may not provide adequate transport of sediment and organic material. I mean, if that's the kind of criteria, you know, we probably could come up with a lot of different options. So why is that in there? And can somebody use this? This is Joe's fault.
No, they didn't write the board manual.
This is in here per the legislation. as directed by the legislature. The board is to adopt rules incorporating the fish protection standards in the hydraulic code and to approve board manual offering guidance per the guidance in place at the time that the statute became effective. In this case, it's the 2003 culvert guidance for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And within that guidance is the hydraulic method. And so what the group, the stakeholders, opted to do was to present methods for design in a descending order of preference. And so we added a lot of qualifying language in the use of this method, and in many ways have attempted to discourage the use of this method. However, it is in the guidance, and we are mandated through the legislation to include it within the manual at this time.
So it is a real option,
though. It is a real option, as I understand it. It's a viable option in some cases, particularly around retrofitting an existing pipe, where there is still a life of pipe issue. There's still the ability for the pipe to, it does not need an immediate replacement.
Yeah, I think the manual notes subsequently that commonly used for temporary retrofits of existing barrier culverts.
And that's the temporary nature, is that it's the remaining life of the pipe. The intent is when you need to replace that structure, that you will replace it using a methodology to assure the passage of fish.
Some fish, some of the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to speak to the same issue, and I know that the two tribal representatives on the work group had flagged this issue, and while I think we were all pretty happy with how the whole process worked out, this was one particular issue where the tribal representatives could support, and we don't support for many of the reasons that, that Tom said. I think we were concerned with its the federal laws, for instance, the ESA, the federal agencies recognize the stream simulation design method as the best available science. And they require that in the DNR HCP and the Fish and Forest HCP that we employ best available science. So you've got a standard design in here that doesn't meet that we're including in our manual here. So that was one of the concerns that we had. I guess because the WDFW is currently reviewing the hydraulic code, maybe I would put Joe on the spot and see if this these kinds of changes or corrections could be addressed in there, and then in this process where we reconcile what changes that they make with our rules in the future, if we can't correct this situation through that process, is maybe the best way we can hope to fix this.
You guys setting me up because I'm the new guy? I think the words in the board manual are there for the reasons that Mark explained, you know, where the group is following the direction from the legislature and existing guidelines containing those options. I think, you know, you're putting your finger on one of the tougher issues. We talked earlier about the HPA rule revisions and focusing on where those tougher issues are, and the design, these kinds of design options, the range, where they're used, how much they cost, all of those aspects of culvert replacement are going to be one of the more challenging issues for us to come together on, I think, as a group when we go through that rule revision. So.
But it will be looked at in the rule revision?
Yes.
So just to follow up, again, as far as when we just vote to whether we approve or not, manual the position at least that I need to take is to oppose because of the, and also this is really inconsistent with the recent Culvert case decision. And I realize that case is on hand. It applies to state roads at this point, but we're looking at stream simulation design. Culverts as a standard there as well.
Mr. Chair, I think in terms of the rule revision, you know, that standard is out there, and we're interested in looking at the endpoints you might achieve with that standard and where that's applicable, but what are some other sorts of alternative ways to get to the same place? I mean, I think that'll be part of the discussion too. How do you get to the same resource protection endpoints? If there's more way than one, you know, if there's an equivalency somehow, that'll be part of what we talk about.
Okay, so we want to keep rolling through the sections, noting that we've got a little divergence of opinion on this one.
Okay. I do want to second Pete's recognizing the effort and time that went in this. In fact, a lot of folks in the room had a hand, different expertise from Fish and Wildlife and College, from tribes, from landowners, make a great manual so that there's less need to rely on rules. We got people doing great stuff on the ground because they're implementing a manual, and we're successful. So I'm certainly for Gretchen Robinson for her management of the documents and the meetings. It's amazing. So as a result of the Fish Forest Practice Hydraulic Project rulemaking, four other manuals needed to be amended because they directed beaters and applicants to go get a HPA, Hydraulic Project Approval from Fish and Wildlife. Now, with those projects under DNR, there's no need for that. So we had to work with that language to remove it, to read. In some cases, we just took it out and replaced it with application. So where it said, when designing fish crossing structures, go see Fish and Wildlife, we've taken that out, said when designing fish passage projects, get an application. Those four manual sections are Section 3, Guidelines for Forest Roads, Section 4, Guidelines for Clearing Slash and Debris from Type N and NS Waters, NP and NS Waters, Section 21, Guidelines for Alternate Plans, and Section 26, Guidelines for Large Woody Debris Placement Strategies. Again, these we looked at these sections, they had that HPA language. We wanted to make a consistency with now the rules under forest practices. I want to specifically mention Section 3 for forest roads. As I mentioned earlier, one of the big parts of this one was we have taken out the water crossing structure guidance for type N waters, which was originally in Section 3, and we placed that under Section 5, the Forest Practice Hydraulic Project Board Manual section, for consistency with all water crossing structures. And then a note that we will be changing for Board Manual Section 3 is on page 34. And I don't know if I have it. But on 34, in the glossary, we have our definition of forest practice hydraulic project. Okay, that's on the board. And we will be adding the second half, the underlying bit, standalone proposals involving channel change, realignment, dredging in freshwater areas, and constructing outfall structures are not forest practice hydraulic projects and remain governed under Chapter 775 RCW and Chapter 220. 110. That is not, I believe, and not in your version, your packet materials, but that's what we'll be adding on with your permission. Other than that, there are no changes that need to be made to these